Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa. Buddhang Namang Sanghang Namassami. So I've written down the title of the talk, just so I keep myself on track. Creating our world, do we have a choice? And this is something I was asked to do a couple of days ago, and I was quite excited because it's a very interesting theme for me. And so what I intend is to spend the next, well, maybe a bit less than an hour, just kind of talking around the topic, and then we'll have a break, and then a chance for people to ask questions about anything I've said that didn't seem clear or sensible, or if you have any challenges or other questions even about practice, I'd be very happy to have a go at answering them. Partly I like the topic because I used to get very annoyed when people used to say about, well, we create our world, don't we? And I couldn't quite get it. And when we think about creating our world, and what I was pondering was how, you know, in some ways we do create our worlds. We choose how and where we live. We choose the kind of things that we surround ourselves with. We choose the people we associate with. So in some sense, there are ways that we can have an influence, have an effect on our surroundings, if we think of our surroundings as being the world we live in. You know, we can, you know, if we've got enough money, we can create, you know, the most fantastic world to live in. Just surrounding ourselves with the most beautiful, beautiful sort of decor, objects, sounds, fragrances, and we can take care of our bodies in ways we can pamper ourselves, dress in the most beautiful clothes, and associate with very refined, beautiful people. And there are people who do this, the fabulously wealthy people on the planet. They do try to create a world that they feel comfortable living in, that will gratify them in some way. And you know, in some ways, this is perfectly understandable. I mean, probably many of us would like to do that. We'd like to have more choice in the kind of world in which we lived. And we can feel some envy for the people who have the means to create the most sublime surroundings for themselves. And we can also think in terms of the planet itself, the world, the planet that we call the world. And obviously this is something that many people are deeply concerned about these days. And I would suggest quite rightly so, because the way that the resources are used, squandered, the amount of things that we create, kind of computers and gadgets and motor cars and houses and things. I mean, there's constant sort of manufacturing of things, more and more things. And what on earth do you do with them when they wear out? You sort of throw them into the ocean, some kind of bottomless pit that will receive it all. Never mind the, you know, pollution of the planet, the effects of pollution. Now, these are all senses in which humanity is creating a particular kind of world. And I would suggest in this, in some ways, there seems to be less choice. I mean, even if we were all seriously committed to combating the effects of climate change and global warming and all the rest of it, the effect would not be that great. Not that I'm suggesting we don't keep making efforts to do our recycling and to be careful and to be frugal and not to have more than we actually really need to live reasonably comfortable lives. At the same time, if we're really considering having any kind of effect on the world itself, as an individual, it's fairly limited. I mean, I wouldn't say it's hopeless at all. I mean, that would be very very unfortunate thing to say. And it's certainly good to consider these things. But it's rather, in some ways, I think in relation to this question, it's quite a coarse level of speaking about it. And I think when we reflect inwardly on such a question, we can take it down to a level where actually we can have a significant choice. We have the capacity to have a significant choice. And my sense is that that's what Amarawati is all about. It's about creating the conditions, the opportunity for us to reach a level of understanding where we can have a significant choice and effect on the world that we create. There's a passage in the scriptures, which I always like to contemplate, where the Buddha says that within this fathom-long carcass, he calls it a carcass, lies the world, the origin of the world, and the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world, that there is a sense of the world in which it's all within our own bodies and minds, our own personal humanity, that we can contemplate at that kind of level and consider what might be another way of understanding this question. So that's what I'd like to talk about a little bit more this afternoon, just to maybe just awaken the possibility in our minds of actually having some sense of how it is that we create the world and how we can begin to have a choice. When we don't reflect on our lives in this way, there actually isn't any choice. When we don't really look into our lives and how our sense of ourselves, where we live, how we live, what's important to us, when we don't consider that at all and consider where that arose from, we're just caught into our views. What I mean by this is that, well, we're born into, and many of us, born into a family situation, born in a particular culture, particular society. And for many people here, it's a British culture. For some people, it's grew up in quite a different culture, perhaps, from the culture that may be prevalent in this country. Although Britain is becoming more and more multicultural, which is quite wonderful. But we have to acknowledge that in the world there are many, many different cultures, many different ways that people live. Different geographical surroundings. It's something I've been contemplating a lot recently, actually. It's a little digression here. Many of you may know that I live up in Scotland now. And it's quite interesting for me just to notice the effect of being in a particular landscape. just the effect that that has on the mind. You know, so the kind of things that I contemplate up in Scotland, the most exciting event of the day the other day was finding a hedgehog. This little, well, it was actually a sort of bundle of grass, a kind of, and I didn't know what it was. I picked it up and it was much heavier than I expected and kind of warm, kind of like a small cannonball, really. And then I was just curious. I sort of unraveled it a little bit. And then this little hedgehog curled up, sound asleep. So I apologized and wrapped it up again and put it back where it was. And a few minutes later, there was a little kind of wiggling, a sort of shuffling, and this little nose appeared. And then the hedgehog came out and sort of wandered off down to the pond. And noticing the birds, the swallows, when they come and go, noticing we have red squirrels, and so I have a lot of fun just watching the squirrels and just the space. There's not many people up there, and that's has a very interesting effect on the mind. It affects the mind. So it's interesting to notice that, and a sense of good fortune to be able to live in such an environment. Here at Amarawati, it's a different environment. It's also in the countryside. There's wide open spaces. There's many people. And here the many large Buddha figures, these images that have an effect on the mind, and the kind of encouragement to practice is very much part of what happens here at Amarawati. The encouragement to each one of us to reflect on our lives, to consider our lives as human beings, to really make this human birth a precious human birth. I'm listening to Tenzin Palmo talking a few weeks ago in Edinburgh. She was talking about the precious human birth. And I've often wondered about this because some humans have pretty difficult situations that they live in. They don't have the opportunity to hear Dhamma. They live in places where there's quite severe physical deprivation, poverty. Some people just don't have enough water to drink, don't have enough to eat. And so she was saying, but actually a precious human birth is a human birth in a place where there is a reasonable degree of comfort and the opportunity to hear the teachings and to practice. So for all of us living either here at Amarawati or close by, able to come here, that's a very, very precious opportunity that we have. So when you wake up in the morning one day and feel a bit glum, you can actually think, but this is a precious human birth. You know, how can I really make this into something very, very precious? So I'm beginning to kind of enter into the area where we have a bit of choice. So when we wake up and we feel glum, we can either allow ourselves to sink down, get glummer and glummer, think of all the difficult, bad things about our lives, or we can actually think, this is a precious human birth. And just try to make that as a very strong image in the mind, just the preciousness of this opportunity, the capacity to wake up, the capacity to look into our lives, to contemplate our lives, to see clearly, rather than just to be helplessly bound up, ensnared in the patterns of conditioning. Because as I was saying, we grow up in different cultures, we're affected by different influences. I mean, even the kind of things that our mother was doing when she was pregnant with us, you know, the kind of music she listened to. I mean, they say that the unborn child is very much affected by sound, you know, the sounds going on around the mother. I mean, it's probably a little bit like, you know, if I was sitting in the sala and someone was having, I don't know, playing some heavy rock music in the morning room. You know, it's probably not that much different. In fact, sort of the sala, the colours of the walls are probably quite womb-like, sort of reddish colour. So realising that even from the time that we're conceived, we're affected by the impressions that we receive through the senses. And then obviously we're born and we're received by the mother, and we grow up within a particular context. And for many people, hopefully most people grow up in a fortunate situation with loving parents and receive enough of what they need to survive. But there'll be many people who aren't so fortunate and maybe suffer abuse or all kinds of quite severe deprivation and hardship. And this makes an impression on the mind. You know, the kind of things that we hear, the kind of influences that we receive, the impressions that we receive, has an influence. It affects the way that we see things. And I was very shocked just 2 or 3 days ago. A mother and her daughter came to Milne Tuam. They wanted to help with some work, and I was taking them up to the woods to gather up some wood, bring it down for the winter, for the fires. And they'd been living in a particular area in the neighbouring town, and they were just saying what a difficult neighbourhood they lived in. Just everybody, every second household seemed to have people who were sort of drug addicts, alcoholics, and people would be yelling at each other in the streets. If you went to the playground, you'd find needles and things from people injecting heroin. And you just think, well, that's a really difficult environment for people to grow up in, for children to grow up in. And the ways that kids treat each other at school, I mean, it all has an effect. And so it's interesting, I think, to just actually consider how you see the world, and to realize that the way that you grew up has an effect. And one little exercise I was thinking that we could try just for fun is, you know, just to take 2 or 3 minutes just to look around the room, and just to look at all the people in the room, not everybody, but just look around us at the people sitting beside us and in front of us, and just to sort of notice the impression, and not with any kind of judgment, but just to notice any kind of impressions that arise in your mind about the people. I mean, most of you don't know each other, and the ones that you do know each other, it'll be even more interesting, in fact. But just we can just take a few moments just to do that, to look at each other. You know, and we can notice whether this person seems friendly or hostile or a bit dumb. Or not somebody that you'd want to talk to, or somebody that you'd be very interested to talk to. And just notice how quick we are to judge. You know, how quick we are to kind of create an assumption about something that we've seen, an impression of a person. Or coming into the sala. I mean, some of you maybe are here for the first time. I mean, how does that strike you? It's a pretty unusual situation, you know, with someone like me sitting up here, and then the Buddha figure behind, and more Buddhas there, and you know, what kind of a place is this? You know, if you've not been here before, and then the board up there looks like school, doesn't it? Sort of days of the week and nice clear writing. So it's like school. It can remind us of school, and you might think, oh gosh, I had a terrible time at school. I don't like Amarawati. It's like school. So you know, we create an instant judgment. So it's interesting to notice how we do that. Those of you who've been here many times, who've lived here for many years, I mean, those of you who've lived here for many years, you know, probably hardly even notice. I mean, it's a sala, it's so familiar, just don't even notice it, you know, unless something changed radically. Or if you were looking for something. I mean, quite often I lose my hat, and so if I come to the sala and I've lost my hat, then my whole focus is on trying to find my hat. That's my world at that time, the lost hat that I have to find. So the world becomes very narrow at that point. So that's a kind of unconscious creation of the world. This is just something that happens, you know, just based on our experience. our impressions of each other, our impressions of a particular situation. One of the reasons that these talks happen like this is we have seats in rows, we have a clear program, is for people who are not familiar with Amarawati so that they can actually feel at home. It's something a bit familiar, like going to the movies or the theatre or a concert. You come in here and you sit down on a seat and there's a program, so you know where you are. It's not too strange. So to create a world that's a little bit familiar, so that when you walk in and see the place, you won't suddenly feel that it's a kind of threatening or unfriendly place. So you'll be able to relax and hopefully be able to enjoy contemplating the teachings of the Buddha and applying them in your own life. I'm interested in how my world can change quite dramatically. It was interesting the couple of mornings ago when I was at Miltume and I was just coming to the end of some retreat time, and I was feeling a bit glum. I can't quite remember why, whether it was something about me or something about the situation I was in or something about the nuns' community, or whether it was just it was a dull, gloomy kind of day. I think that was probably had a lot to do with it. And then I was in retreat, so I was staying in this little kind of hut we have beside the house, and there was a basket with my breakfast in, this little note saying, Ajahn Sundara rang and asked if you'd be willing to give a talk on Sunday. Creating our world, do we have a choice? And it was interesting because immediately the glum world just evaporated, and suddenly I was kind of interested and thought, oh, yes, I could do that. There was a kind of a brightening that happened. And that was very nice to notice, just how quickly it can change. And I can't remember. I mean, I'm sure it went through many changes during the day. It usually does go through many changes. But this is actually something that each one of us can notice, how our world can change. I mean, a lot of our world is actually about me, isn't it? You know, how I am in relation to somebody else, how I am in relation to how I should be. Have you noticed how that can be a big thing? You know, I should be better. My meditation should be better. My meditation is useless. When I sit down to meditate, my mind is all over the place. I can't meditate, so I don't think I'll bother. It's too much, too difficult. And so what I always say is that meditation is not about, I mean, it's very nice when the mind does calm down, but actually just making the effort to sit there with the mind as it is, that's good meditation. Just the fact that you don't get up and run away and make a cup of tea, that you actually sit there for the time you've allocated for yourself. So just to notice the way that we create ourselves and our world. I remember one time, one of the novices at Chithurst, she was living in a kuti. She had a very, very nice little kuti. And in those days, we used to have a working period in the morning, and then the afternoon was completely free time. And I noticed that she spent a lot of time in her kuti, and yet she was always complaining that she didn't have enough time to herself. And I was kind of puzzled about this. And eventually I asked her, I said, well, what happens when you go into your kuti? You know, what do you think about? Do you think about other people? And it turned out that she would go to her kuti, and she'd bring the whole community along with her. She'd just sit there and she'd be pondering all the things that had happened and all the people that she was living with and all the things that she had to do and all the things that were wrong and all the things that were right. And her mind was just full of people. Have you noticed that? Or full of things to do. Like, I mean, I think life does move much more quickly nowadays and people do have things to do. But have you noticed how you can walk around and just feel totally exhausted because of all the things in your mind. Your world is just full of things to do. I like to notice this because I like to notice when I've got things to do in my mind. And to notice, this is when we begin to see that we have a choice with practice. You begin to see that actually, how is it if I just, instead of thinking about the things I have to do, is just take one breath? How is it if I just stop? Like we had those couple of minutes at the start of the talk with nothing to do. I hope you all enjoyed the feeling of nothing to do. Or did you kind of go through all the lists of things that you were going to have to do afterwards? I hope not. I hope you had a chance to just really taste just the peacefulness, the pleasure of nothing to do. That's the great thing about waiting, isn't it? You know, when you're waiting for something and there's nothing else you can do, you can just sit and wait and enjoy the feeling of nothing to do. It's like giving yourself a little holiday. Maybe not quite the same as going away for 3 weeks to the Bahamas, but it's a little breathing space. So it can be interesting just to take a moment or two just to contemplate the kind of world that we live in and the kind of influences, the kind of things that we expose ourselves to. You know, I feel very fortunate that I hardly ever see TV and occasionally read a newspaper. I feel fortunate because I think these things have a very powerful effect on the mind. And when I do involve myself with these things, if I'm not quite vigilant, quite careful, I can create a world that's actually full of things to be frightened of. You know, if it's not terrorists and it's some ghastly disease or global warming or the eco-crisis or something, there's something pretty awful about to happen. And this is just the way the mind works when it receives these things. It's affected by them. It affects the world that we live in. So within this fathom-long carcass, the impressions that we see receive through the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body itself, causes the arising of a world, our worldview. So this can be a very strong encouragement to consider carefully what we put into, what we receive, what we subject ourselves to. Now, obviously, the extent to which we can choose is somewhat limited. I mean, particularly those of you who don't live in a monastery, there are things that you have to see and hear that you're affected by. Actually, living in the monastery, you can also be affected by things as well. And more importantly, it's quite interesting to consider, like the Buddhist idea of the mind also being a sense. So it's not just what we receive from outside or from within the body itself, but it's the way that we think about things, the way that we ponder in our own minds, the kind of thoughts that we have. You know, one of the great things about meditation, and particularly when the mind is not calm, is that we have a sense to observe the kind of ways that we think, the kind of things that we allow to get a hold in the mind. You know, are we always finding fault? Are we always blaming, judging, criticizing ourselves or each other? You know, is that what we do? I think for many of us it is, a lot of the time. You know, and it happens in subtle ways. You know, I tend to do quite a lot of editing work. You know, I read stuff and then I look at it carefully and look where the comma should be and the full stop and when how to express things. And that demands a very critical mind. You know, the mind gets very small. The world is very small. I can spend half an hour focused on one sentence, how to get it, You know, and that's my world at that time. That's the world I live in. So I have to step back, take a breath, look at a tree, look at the sky, so that my mind is filled up with something other than these words on the page. So beginning to see how we can actually expand our mind, expand our world, and consider things from a much broader perspective. So encouraging us all to become more conscious of the way that the thinking happens, the way that we respond to things, affects our world. I don't know if you've noticed, like, the people who are most happy are the ones who are generous-hearted, you know, who are able to give the benefit of the doubt, who look out for ways that they can offer support and kindness. They don't miss an opportunity to be kind, to be helpful to somebody else. That brings a lot of joy. It creates a joyful place and a joyful environment, a mental climate. Whereas if we're always finding fault, blaming, criticizing, judging, what does that do to the mind? What kind of world is that to live in? Do we really want to live in such a world? Never mind the other worlds that exist. I mean, I don't even like to even think about them, the sort of worlds that many people live in the big cities and so on, the whole sort of pornography thing and drugs, alcohol, all of that. You know, these kind of worlds where there's just an obsession with gratifying the senses in one way or another, you know, seeking the most interesting, stimulating experience, you know, creating that kind of world for ourselves where we're always on the lookout for something that's going to be even more pleasurable, more wonderful. In the monastery, we have an opportunity to contemplate the subtler kinds of pleasures from a peaceful mind, the joy of renunciation, the joy of simplicity. This is a different kind of world that we live in. Now, I realize in some ways I'm rather innocent. I just live in a very rather refined situation with people and in an environment where there's a strong focus on precepts, on living carefully, living responsibly with each other, rather than taking advantage of every situation, getting what one can from it. You know, so is our world one where we want to get as much as we can from it, or is it a world that we want to give as much as we can, a world that we want to serve in a way that brings joy and gladness into our lives? So what I'm talking about is about habits, our habitual responses to the different impressions we receive, our habitual reactions, and, you know, our tendency to jump to conclusions about people and situations, and to feel that that's perfectly normal. I mean, it is perfectly normal, but to see that as long as we do that, we're bound into a pattern of reactivity. And to begin to see, to begin to recognize these habits and these patterns of reactivity, and to see that actually we don't have to. We have a choice with mindfulness. We can choose. We can begin to adjust, to transform our ways of thinking, our ways of responding. There's one topic that I'd really like to talk a little bit about in relation to all of this. And it's, there's a, after the Buddha was enlightened, it's described how immediately after his enlightenment, he contemplated what are called the dependent origination. Those of you who are familiar with the life of the Buddha will know that he lived a life of luxury, He grew up as a prince. He had everything he could possibly want. He was surrounded by beauty and by pleasures of one kind or another. He was received every encouragement to become a great ruler, a powerful ruler, extremely wealthy, and with a large kingdom. This was what he was being prepared for. And then suddenly, at the age of 29, he woke up to the fact that he was going to die. And suddenly everything, all the values that he'd been grown up with, suddenly no longer had any interest for him at all. He just thought, well, what's the point? Why am I doing this? What's the point? Old age, sickness, death. And then the fourth heavenly messenger, the religious person, he thought, well, maybe there is a way of making sense of this. You know, everybody seems to be wanting these same things, and it just leads to death, to old age, sickness, death. What's the point? So he then left home, left his family, and spent 6 years or so practicing austerities, trying to find a way to make sense of the apparently pointless experience of human existence. You know, you just get born, and you die, basically. You get and that's what happens. You get born, get rich perhaps, or maybe lose everything you've got, whatever. You have a certain number of experiences, and then that's the end. Poof. And just trying to understand, to make sense of it. And so for 6 years he struggled, and he thought that the answer was just to get rid of desire, that if he could just subdue his bodily desires, that would sort it. And then realized that actually that wasn't... after almost killing himself through fasting and the austerities that he'd undertaken, he realized that wasn't the way. And so he came to a more balanced approach to his practice. And then afterwards, once he kind of had come to this place of sublime peace and happiness, and nibbana we call it, he then kind of contemplated in a very analytical, very step-by-step kind of way, just contemplated how suffering arises, basically. And I'm quite interested in this. I used to find, well, it is very complicated in some ways, but it's there are other ways in which it's less complicated. But just looking at how ignorance, out of ignorance, we create concepts, ideas. Out of ignorance, we create things, a sense of me, a sense of you, a sense of the world. That's how the world arises, our sense of the world. It's a created, avijja paccaya sankhara. Ignorance, not seeing clearly, creates a sense of the world and me as a human being, as a person in the world. Me as separate from you. And then it leads step by step to rebirth and to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Suffering, basically. So what is it that we need to see? What is it that we're not clear about? What constitutes this ignorance, avijja? What is this not seeing? What are we not seeing clearly that brings about this tendency to keep creating and recreating the world that we live in, that gives us a sense of me in the world? Having formulated the 12 links of dependent origination, the Buddha then gave his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. Life as a human being is difficult. I think we'd all agree with that. It has its difficult moments for all of us. There is stress, there is struggle. There is stress and struggle because of wanting. Because of wanting things to be other than the way that they are. Suffering ends when we relinquish that wanting, when we accept that this is how things are, when we give up the struggle for things to be otherwise, when we come to terms with the facts of human existence. So what are these facts that we need to come to terms with? We need to come to terms with the fact that nowhere in this human realm, in the conditioned world, is there a lasting, anything that can provide lasting satisfaction and ease. This doesn't mean that there aren't wonderful moments. It doesn't mean that much of our life, I'm getting into my double negatives again. It doesn't mean that there are significant chunks of time when we can experience lots of pleasure and where things can be really wonderful and delightful. We all of us can experience that, and I hope everybody does have plenty of that. But it doesn't last. Not even the most wonderful experience can last forever. So even the most wonderful experience has its unsatisfactory element. Dukkha is the word. And of course, the unpleasant, you know, these bodies, they're subject to all kinds of discomfort. You know, we get cold, we get hungry, we get thirsty, we begin to ache, we begin to fall apart, and all kinds of dreadful things happen to these bodies, and then they die. So just having a body involves quite a lot of physical discomfort and pain, and this is normal. So in that sense, the body is not a satisfactory refuge. We can experience pleasure through the body, but we can also experience significant amounts of discomfort. So life as a human being has its unsatisfactory element because it's impermanent, it's continuously changing. And the third thing, so there's change, which is impermanence, it's unsatisfactory. The third thing that is most interesting for us to contemplate is that there's no inherent lasting selfhood, that the personality is a creation of the mind. A personality is a creation of the mind. It's mind-made. It's not who and what we are, essentially. Like if, supposing we were to have a period of meditation now, which I think we probably won't, but if we were to close our eyes and just sit very still and very quiet, and if I was to ask you, where are you? I doubt that you'd find yourself, actually. I doubt that you'd find anything there. There's the experience of the body, there's the thinking mind, but essentially, there's no me, there's no you. There is a personality, yes. We've all of us been born into a family. We have a name. We have a position in the family. We have relationships, and these are all very, very useful concepts. But they're not who and what we are essentially. When we identify with these things, when we claim them as part of our identity, this is a way of creating a world, me in relation to the world, and creating the potentiality for suffering, for dukkha. So the Buddha encourages us to really contemplate our existence, you know, our bodies and minds, and just to sort of keep, to analyze, you know, the body, the feelings, perception, mental formations, consciousness, to see that these things are not an inherent sense of selfhood. They're just a kind of put together conglomerate. I am a conglomerate. So it's a subtle distinction to see that there is a conventional reality. You know, in one sense, of course I'm a human, well, we're all human beings. Of course I'm a nun. You know, I've undertaken this lifestyle, this way of training. There are certain rules and obligations. There are certain things I'm supposed to do and not supposed to do. And I do my best to train myself within that form. That's what being a nun is about. But that's not what I am essentially. When I'm in my quiet moments, I'm not. In another context, I'm something else. Yesterday, was it the day before? Yeah, yesterday I was with my family, my brother, my sister, my in-laws. I was with my family, so I was a sister at that point, a sibling, an older sibling. I come here and I have my nun siblings, my sisters. These are all relationships. These are all a part of a world, but it's not as we practice more and more, as we question, as we challenge these conventions more and more, we begin to see that actually this is just a creation of the mind. And if we identify with it, if we latch onto it, it will cause us stress, suffering. So it's not that we shouldn't latch onto it or that we're bad for latching onto it, it's that we need to wake up. You know, as long as we don't see clearly, as long as there's a vicha, there'll be the tendency to create these concepts, these ideas. And the biggest one of all, me. Me in relation to you. So in one sense, we don't have a choice because the patterns of conditioning are very strong. But as we practice more and more, as we look into our lives more and more, we begin to see that actually we do have a choice. You know, so sometimes, you know, I mean, it's actually I find it a very exciting, very interesting practice. And I don't always enjoy it, I have to say. I really dislike being upset. And community life is full of times when you get upset because people don't always agree with me. Would you believe it? I have all these wonderful ideas and people don't always agree. And I don't like that. I really don't like it when people disagree with me. But it gives me a really important opportunity to study and to see, well, what's going on here? What's this feeling of hotness and wanting to punch that person in the nose? What's that about? And you begin to see it's me. This sense of self arising up. There's an expression like sticking out like a sore thumb. So if you stick out like a sore thumb, if your buttons get pressed and you suddenly find yourself standing up, you make yourself very vulnerable. You know, you can be bashed. Whereas if you just, you know, disarm. I like the encouragement to harmlessness, like our first precept, to refrain from consciously, intentionally, deliberately causing harm to any other living being, or to ourselves for that matter. Very powerful teaching, powerful contemplation, and remarkably difficult. But when we have this precept, it gives us a chance to see the sense of selfhood arising and the world that we create. You know, what was it about what that person said or did that has made me so angry? What world did I create? What have I created about the situation? You know, maybe, you know, she thinks she's better than me or something, or she thinks she's senior to me. How dare she? She thinks she's senior to me. Gets very petty when you in monastic life. We can get very petty. It's embarrassing how petty we can get over little things. But I mean, the beauty of it is that we can see it very clearly because it's so petty. And it gives us a chance to really contemplate how that happens. As a layperson, it's more difficult because there are so many more ways that you can create a sense of self and be somebody. But I mean, supposing, you know, two people turn up in the same outfit. You know, I've heard of, you know, stories where people go to these, you know, balls and suddenly you kind of see somebody else who's wearing the same dress. It's like a major disaster. How dare she? you know, I thought I had the best dress or whatever. It's very sad. I mean, it's interesting how the Buddha, when he first was thinking about teaching, he was actually very reluctant because he didn't think that humanity was going to be very interested in understanding selfhood and wouldn't be really ready to relinquish either the sense of selfhood or the kind of pleasures that they were enjoying. He felt that they were just caught up, totally caught up in seeking pleasure, seeking status, seeking fame, seeking wealth, and that they wouldn't really be interested in the promise, the possibility of peace, of letting go. But then when he surveyed the world with his kind of supernormal sight, he was able to see that there were beings who were suffering, who were struggling, and who were aware of that struggle, aware of that suffering, who were ready to hear the teachings and to apply the teachings in their lives. And so it was out of compassion for them that he presented the teaching. And I find that very beautiful, and I'm eternally grateful, because certainly I suffer a lot, and I have suffered a lot, and I've been grateful that there is a possibility of working with the causes of suffering, understanding the desires that bring about the causes of suffering, and a chance to actually let go of those. I think one of the worst things for me was the feeling of people being better than me, a kind of jealousy. And I talk about this because I realize it's actually quite a common difficulty. When I've talked about it with other people, in fact, the young girl who came to Miltum the other day, she said, "Oh yes, I have that. I look around at my friends and I think, oh, she's better at this and she's better at that." And I said to her, "What are you good at?" And it turned out that she was really good at other things. And she was actually really good at supporting people, helping people. And so I said, "Well, rather than looking at what other people have got and thinking that you have to be like them, why don't you try counting your own blessings? You know, looking at the qualities that you have in this lifetime and really making much of that, celebrating that." So celebrating your own goodness, your own beauty. Not from a kind of ego point of view, but just from a sense of appreciation. You know, each one of us, you know, although we're nobody, and although there's no essential self, each one of us has a mind and a body, has qualities, has gifts, skills, aptitudes, has a mind, has the capacity for reflection and the capacity to use. I mean, these hands, these feet, this voice, we can do a lot of good things in our lives, even if it is all empty, even if we are going to end in death in a short while. Let's make the very best opportunity, the best, take advantage of the situation that we have, use it in the best possible way that we can, and see if we can't create a positive, a bright, a happy, joyful world, even in the midst of enormous amounts of suffering that we hear about all the time. But just to consider how we can transform that suffering, or at least just simply witness it with a peaceful heart, rather than adding to it with our sense of rage and fury. And worry. And worry is a real, we can be very good at worrying about things. Have you noticed? Do you worry? I worry. I'm very good at worrying. So it can be, that can be another useful thing to contemplate, just how much we worry. And then just to come to the breath and think, right now I'm breathing. There's a breath happening here. Right now I can relax my face, I can relax my shoulders, I can feel the chair underneath me. I can establish presence. I don't have to worry about who and what I am and where I'm going and whether I'm any good or not. I can just be here now. So we've got to 5 to 3, and I think maybe I'll give a second, a few seconds, just to see if there's anything else that pops up as a way of wrapping this up a little bit more neatly, and then we can have a little break. I think perhaps one of the most important things is to really contemplate these noble truths and to contemplate really where our suffering comes from. We're so ready to blame everybody else and what's happening around us. And the Buddha pointed to the importance of right view, right understanding. And there's a very beautiful simile that he uses, which is just as the dawn foretells the arising of the sun, in the same way right view foretells the arising of a perfect understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And these Four Noble Truths, suffering, the reason why we suffer is through not understanding, through the attachment to desire. Cessation of suffering happens when we relinquish that desire, not stop having the desire, but we relinquish our attachment to it. And freedom from suffering comes when we develop the path. There is a path, there is a way of life, a training that we can pick up and use in our lives that will lead us gradually, step by step, and in the same way, like the arising of the sun, lead us gradually to the experience of perfect liberation from all suffering. So the way out is within. So I offer this for your contemplation this afternoon.